This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
Excellent. Good to hear your voice, too. Before we begin, we've got some questions in the queue. Before we begin, I was perusing the internet and came across some webinar that Dr. Lyle was doing. Dr. Lyle, you were doing. And it was about how to tell people when you're interested in something, how to essentially show them that you enjoyed something without turning them off of it. So your technique, I think it was like a seam strategy where, mm-hmm. you read a book, you really like it, and you just kind of pass it off of like, oh yeah, it's no big deal. I kind of read half the pages here and there and didn't even read the whole thing and seemed to make some sense. And basically your technique was you're trying to get the other person to outcompete you. So did I understand that right?
Yeah. In other words, we wouldn't want to have people feel like that if they were interested and went and got the book, that they would always be second place to you. So that's the idea is that they could actually beat you to the end of the book, and therefore they could be the authority rather than you. So yeah, that's just a little nuance that's particularly useful when we're talking about books that are involving health advice. Which has a moral undertone to it that we want to avoid. So that's the idea there.
Ah, okay. So I thank you for clarifying that, because there was a little nuances that I didn't quite get in your explanation. So the reason I brought this up is because a couple of days ago, a friend of mine asked me, well, what's a book that changed my life and why? And I told him The Pleasure Trap by Dr. Lyle. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, what's that book? What's it about? And so in trying to use your technique, all I replied was, oh, some psychologist blabbering about happiness.
There you go. That's more or less right. There you go. Good job.
Yeah. So I was wondering, probably a better way to say it was I read a couple of pages and it seemed to make some sense, but what is about, I mean, it's different for everybody.
That's pretty good. There you go.
Okay. So a little plug for your book. That was not intentional. I just came up recently, and that's why I decided to bring it up. But,
good idea. All right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go on with these questions. We're going to go straight to them. I changed the title of this podcast, right as we started. So we've got a couple of different questions in, and, let's just get right down to it. Dear Dr. Lyle, I've made it to 10 paid dates with a man I met a couple of months ago on an online dating site. He's 58, I'm 53. We both have been single for a very long time, and I would say we're both very similar on the looks scale, but perhaps I might be slightly higher in terms of attraction. The dates have been really nice and fairly expensive. They've all been centered around fun activities like gondola rides, mountain hikes, opera tickets, show tickets, the number of other plays and events. All of these dates also include dinners out before the events. I've been having a lot of fun with them, and we've only kissed finally after the eighth date, which was his move. But there's been no other moves by either one of us other than the end of date kiss on dates 8, 9, and 10. I'm attracted to him, and I'm enjoying the speed that the relationship is moving. And he's not pushing for anything more at this point. So I'm wondering, why is he moving so slow? Though, as I'm used to men trying to move things along at a lot faster rate than he is. Also, I'm wondering, what happens after 10 paid dates? Am I supposed to start paying for some of the dates to even things up? If so, how frequently?
Okay.
He has more money than I do and doesn't seem to expect me to pay so far. I wouldn't be able to afford such nice events on a regular basis as he seems to be able to. Just a little confused. I've been out of the dating world a long time.
That's priceless. We've got a conscientious individual there. Well, for a person who's going out on the dating thing for the first time in a long time, she's getting an A+. She's doing everything just fabulously well. And, you know, I've got people that I know that are listening to this that are struggling with the 10 paid dates idea. And because it's, you know, it can be difficult and it can be confusing to implement, particularly if you're sort of not used to it and you're not sure all of the dynamics that are swirling around you. This is, I almost couldn't have written this up any better if it were fiction. So women out there that are struggling, pay attention. As I've said, when a guy is serious, he's in no rush. This guy is in no rush, and he is behaving this way. This is clearly, his interest is clearly a pair bond strategy. So his big move comes on date 8. In other words, he's accepting in nice, pleasant, excited relief the notion that he continues to be accepted for the next date. Okay? So she's enjoying herself. She finds him attractive enough that she's interested in continuing to be there. He's not pushing at all, very slowly. Okay? He's not wanting to mess up a good thing. This is the difference in behavior behind casual mating strategy and pair bond strategy. So now males can be interested and be willing to gamble on both strategies at the same time. So they're willing to push for casual mating, get rebuffed, slow down, and then play pair bond strategy and then discover whether or not they're really that invested, etc. So that can also be a way that things go. It can also be true that, let's face it, it's quite possible that the male's really interested in the female and the female could be quite interested in the male. And depending upon those personalities and how open to experience they are and how sexual they are by nature, they could be moving along way faster. But if you do that and you're the female, you are risking the possibility that the male will unconsciously infer that he is superior to you, and that is why he was able to get to the egg so early. So that's a serious potential inference that you are risking. So in this case, what we have is a pair bond, you know, a male who, no matter what his history is, he may have been a hound for all we know, undoubtedly not, though, but he could have been. But in this particular case, he believes that he is being highly rewarded in this situation, and therefore he does not want to mess it up. And so this is just beautifully right on target behavior. So now they're kissing at the end of every date now, 8, 9, and 10. Everything is going perfectly according to Dr. Lyle's schedule.
And the listener...
And you are not supposed to be paying for anything. You just keep it right there. Now, at this point, it wouldn't be unreasonable for the female to send some kind of reciprocating cue for that she would be willing to give to the relationship. So this is where you may want to cook dinner for the guy. And so this is a way of you showing that I am willing to be a participant and do things, okay? In other words, be a member of a team. But, yeah, the situation being what it is, you're definitely not going to be starting to offer to pay for anything. This is an old-world gentleman who understands that it's his job to pay the way here, and it's all going away. It's all going beautifully, and good luck to these people. This is great.
Mm-hmm. And so
you're now allowed to sleep with him anytime you want. So this is all we have now smoked out the casual mating motivation out of the male. We have very clear evidence that that is not what this is about. So now it's all good luck, and we'll just see what happens.
Very fascinating. Well, we'll be curious to see how this thing turns out. A follow-up question from one of our listeners pretty months ago on the same question was, what do you think about the book by Ellen Fine called The Rules? It was basically saying that it's hard to get.
Yeah, I never read The Rules. I've certainly heard about it, and I think I read a synopsis once online, and I think The Rules are, they probably have some decent intuition about the kinds of things that I talk about. I don't think that they certainly don't understand the evolutionary underpinning. They're just kind of they're just intuiting some of these things, and I can't imagine that you'd write a whole book about these dynamics and that you'd have a bunch of rules for all these different dynamics. The rules are really pretty simple. Don't allow the male's casual mating strategy to run over the top and miss a potential pair bond. So you do not want to you don't want to put his psychology in a position where he infers that he must be too fancy for you, or you wouldn't have given up the eggs so easily. So this is very much all you need to do to understand the quote rules. I don't know what other little Mickey Mouse rules that they have that they fill the book with, but really this is nothing other than used car negotiating. So if you've got a nice, classic Camaro that is a nice car, and its book value is $14,000, and you believe your car is as good as the book value should be, and you put it on sale for $15,000, hoping to get a buyer that is going to bid a little bit high, give you a little bit more than you were looking for, because you'd be very excited about that. If somebody comes along and says, "Wow, really nice car," would you take $13,000? What you don't do is you don't say, "Sure." Okay? Of course not. You're not going to take less. And if you did that even, then what would happen is the guy on the other side, or let's suppose he offered 14 and you said, "Absolutely." He would think, I could have got it for less. Okay? So even if your target may be 14, we are not going to jump to it. He's going to say, "Well, what's the least you take for it?" And you're going to think, "Well, I'm really not sure. It's been on the market. I'm just getting a lot of good calls. I got a lot of interest. We're just going to see." And he's like, "Well, I want to take it for a test drive." And he's like, "Well, not where it's wet." Okay, so the point is that we're going to slow the process down. The person's going to be aware that you're not jumping at their offer, but you're interested. And when they offer $14,000, you're going to say, "I'll think it over, and I'll kind of get back to you, maybe, and we'll talk." And then they're going to go away, and they're going to think, wow, what about 14.5? And so this is how you would negotiate a car deal. So you got to figure out that this is the very same dynamics that are going on here in man-woman dynamics. And you do not want to be too eager, because if you're too eager, then they feel like their stuff is better than your stuff. So that's why 10 paid dates, but it's conceptual. Do not allow the man to move quickly towards the most valuable thing in the world, which is the female sexuality. Don't allow that process to take place. If you do, there is a very significant chance, I'm not going to say it's certain, but it's significant, that the male's brain may be wired up in such a way where he infers that he can do better, that was too easy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you don't want to do. That's the most fundamental dynamic to the rules. Whatever else is that they say, I can't speak to. But that basic dynamic is the dynamic that we want to honor, and that's what 10 paid dates is about.
Okay. Well, we've got a caller on hold, but I want to ask a follow-up question first, and then we'll get to the caller. So if what you're saying is that the male will subconsciously infer that essentially he's more fancy than the girl.
Yes.
Is it also true that if the male acts in a way that if he mimics, say, you know, arrogance, if he mimics basically alpha-like behavior, then the female infer that he actually is, I guess, more fancy?
Good luck.
Because I remember you said on the podcast a year ago that wasn't true, but I'm wondering why.
Right. Yeah, the reason it's true is fascinating, and it's really great question, Nate. I'm really glad you remembered it and that it's puzzling you. The reason I say so is that this has actually been done in social psychological experiments, and it turns out that what happens is that the females are designed by nature to check it. And so the females will actually, when you watch them with somebody that is essentially bluffing alpha status, that they will cross-examine them and that they will test them in certain ways. And it's going to turn out that if they are not really alpha, they'll fold their tent. So this is, you really cannot bluff being alpha. You either are or you aren't. Okay? So you either believe that you deserve that female's attention and that you have been with 50 just like her and no problem, that you outrank her and that she ought to be on her knees. You either really feel that way or you don't. Okay? And so it turns out that you can't bluff it. And when they've studied this, what they find is that the males that are instructed to bluff, they bluff for a little while and they very quickly run out of steam. So it's interesting. It's a really good question. You would expect that this would be true because over evolutionary time, this is always the joke in, you know, success stuff, like fake it till you make it. Really? Fake what? And who are you bluffing? And do you really think you're going to get away with it? If this were true, then the truth of the matter is that people would be bluffing like crazy all the time and getting away with it. You cannot bluff all the time and get away with it. In fact, you're lucky to ever bluff and be successful. The truth of the matter is that the marketplace, certainly in sexual dynamics being very important, female sexuality being very expensive, and therefore a carefully guarded treasury, the females are not easily duped. And so that's why that is true.
Very interesting. Yeah, I've read about some of this phenomenon now, and you're reminding me of it because, that makes a lot of sense because you can play like you're some alpha, but then the girl will disagree with you somewhere, and you know, just a normal person will be like, okay, honey, I feel you're right. Whereas
you're
an
right.
No,
that's beautifully said. Yeah. You know, I had a guy that I spoke to maybe 15 years ago, and he was desperate to try to be one of these pickup artist players. And he was maybe a 6. And he kept convincing me that the pickup artist guys, you know, you didn't have to be that fancy and you could do this and you could really, you know, really score right off the bat. And this was just unbelievable. This guy was like out of a Tom Vu real estate seminar. This was all about how you're going to get rich quick, easy, and you can just do this, and what you need is a bunch of bluff and bluster. And I'm just listening to this like, you got to be kidding. Yeah, poor guy. And, you know, he was investing a great deal of time, energy, and money in this process. And of course, my attitude is, why don't you go get some serious personal achievement, okay? And quit trying to bluff and actually go in there with a few cards and see how you can play. And the interesting thing about some personalities is they don't want to do it. They don't want to go to the hard work of actually having something interesting to say and something to show. And so, you know, if you're that guy who's a 6 and you want to sleep with 9s, you better have some serious frickin' achievement. At the least, you better be damn good at the guitar. All right.
Let's take our caller.
Sure.
All right, caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Jack in L.A.
All right. Rock and roll, Jack. Tell me what's up.
Yeah. Well, just listening to what you were just saying, my when beta male was kind of in the mainstream, my friend who is a biologist said none of this applies to humans, that it's just chimps. But does it apply to, did it apply to us in the Stone Age?
What are you referring to?
Alpha males and beta males, you know, with humans.
Oh, does it apply in the modern environment? Oh, your friend may be talking about how this is a loose, good, really good question, Jack, and let's get clarification because I know that these concepts are used in modern, you know, discussion, even like the ones we're having, and they're used very loosely without good precision. So in other species, the dominance hierarchies have a tendency to be quite defined. So, and depending upon how the species, they have greater and less precision in terms of their strict verticality. So if you were looking at chickens in a pecking order, that pecking order is surprisingly precise. And in dogs, for example, you're going to find that there's definitely an alpha dog, then there's a beta dog, et cetera. I believe that those can be quite precise. In humans, it is not precise. So in humans, it's essentially a little bit different. So let's talk about how human nature, what we're really discussing here in terms of human status, or what I call esteem. I actually have changed my discussions over the last decade to use the word esteem instead of status for various reasons, but one of them is that when you use the word status, it flips everybody out and they get all defensive and they say that they're not seeking it. But if you say, well, what we seek is esteem, everybody nods their head and they're willing to listen. Okay? So that's why I don't call my discussions status dynamics. I call it esteem dynamics. It has a much better flavor, and we get past a lot of human defensiveness about this concept. Now, it's going to turn out that human, but we're going to talk status here because we're not wimps, and we're going to be just straight truth so that we can see it. So it's going to turn out that status is much more diffuse in human nature. So it's going to be the case that if you think about two people looking at a third person in the village, those two people may rate that person's value to them as somewhat different. So one person for example, in the most ultimate example would be two people are looking at some little old lady in the village, and that little old lady is one of them's mother, which means she's really frickin' important. And to the other one, it's nobody important at all. So that woman has a great deal of status with her son, but she has no status with the other guy. Okay? So we can see that status is your total status is an amalgam of all of the little ratings of everybody in the village that they have inside their head of you. And you can imagine, though, that if you are the biggest, strongest hunter in the village, that you have literally, if we were to get inside of everybody's head and get a rating as to how valuable they found you, you would probably be the most valuable member of that village. And so, but everybody would have a little bit different feeling about it. So one guy might rate you third most valuable because he's got two brothers that really love the daylights out of him, and they're both pretty competent people. And quite frankly, he would save either one of those two brothers before he would save you, even though you're theoretically the MVP. Okay? So you're way up there in his eyes. You might be the fifth most valuable guy out of 30, even though the village sees you as number one. So this is how, and you might be overall the MVP of the village. And we could call you legitimately MVP of the village because if we were to add up all of the status that you have, you would have more total status than anybody else. So if we gave everybody a 1 to 30 score and we added up everybody's scores, you would have the highest total rating. It might be 3.37. that might be the highest rated human being in the village. The that would mean, by definition, you are probably the safest person in the village, because it would mean that more total resources would be likely directed, would be directed at saving your hide than would be directed at saving anybody else's hide. Okay? The and so in this way, this is, so now, but what humans don't have is they don't have a situation where, oh, that's alpha, that's beta, that's gamma, that's delta. They don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have that type of status, verticality, or thinking about things. So when we use the term alpha male, this is actually very sloppy, okay? And it is, your friend is right, that it is not
okay.
Actually consistent with human nature. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but we see, when we see a big, strong, or dominant male that actually orders people around, essentially considers himself in charge and is being treated as if he is in charge, we call that an alpha male. But that doesn't mean, you know, but that doesn't mean that the psychology of the human actually simply assigns that to him and then everybody else falls into line. That's not how it works. Okay?
Got it, yeah.
Good question.
Excellent. Jack, thank you very much for the phone call. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
Got it, rock on.
All right.
Okay. Let's go.
Next question. Okay, this is about parenting with societal expectations. So, yeah. Dear Dr. Lyles, two-part question. One is if you know of any parenting books from an evolutionary psychology standpoint, and the second one is about this situation. So, dear Dr. Lyle, my husband and I both did very well in school. My kids are not yet excelling at school. They're just 9 and 11. My son, 11-year-old, has a tough time. I hear the same thing from his teachers year after year. He's very smart, has great things to say in class, but when it comes to his work on paper, he falls short. He does a, quote, job to get things handed in, but he kind of squeaks by on a lot of his assignments. They feel that he's not putting in enough effort. I agree, but I think he's just not engaged. He hates writing, and it affects a lot of his work. But I'm not particularly worried. I think he'll sort it out when he finds a reason to do well in school. I also think he'll be fine in life. He's very good at applying himself when he's interested and is quite resourceful. What I need help with is negotiating other parents, including my spouse, who's the typical Asian parent and is very concerned about his achievement, and negotiating the teachers. I find there's a lot of pressure on me as a mother to teach my kids conscientiousness. They seem to see it as my role to make him want to achieve just for the sake of achieving. They want me to help in developing an intrinsic motivation. That's literally what I just got told the other day. However, I feel like I'm being asked to paint the sky green. Even though I think they're way off base, I have to question, am I doing wrong that this kid doesn't care about making the honor roll to put in the effort? Are these teachers and my spouse out of line? Am I an ineffective parent? Should I be worried about his grades? I'd love any and all advice.
Great question. Just great stuff. Yeah, here's the deal. She is right on target and everybody else is wrong. So you are not going to, like, quote, develop this kid's intrinsic motivation to achieve in school. It's a total joke. This kid's 11 years old, couldn't care less. So this is just a great example of this is what Beat Your Genes is about. So everybody else's genes are running their show. They're like, oh, my God, we've got to get this kid to the top of the dominance hierarchy. Oh, my God, push. Oh, you're doing a terrible job as a parent because your kid's not push to get to the top of the dominance hierarchy. This is a frickin' fiasco. And so she's got a hyper-conscientious spouse that undoubtedly pushed his way as high as he could get in the dominance hierarchy, and he thinks that had he not done that and been working diligently, you know, on his 11th birthday, that he never would have gotten into who knows where, Stanford, never would have become an electrical engineer, never would have gotten a great wife, never would have had three good kids, one of which has got a lazy streak, okay? So, yeah, this is a total fiasco. And now the only question is how we manage these people that are not going to grasp this. So I would there would be a number of strategies that would come to mind. It's always a good idea to blame somebody else. So this is a time to blame Big Louie, is what I call it. And so I can be Big Louie so that we can you can tell the husband and tell the teachers and tell everybody else that, yes, you know, I'm actually following the advice of a motivational psychologist. And what he says is that we're gonna wait a little while before we really get him moving, that we're gonna let him find his way for a while. So he says we've got another year, okay? So we're gonna just punt this down the road for a year. So if the kid's 11, I don't know, what is he in sixth grade? So we're gonna punt it down until seventh grade, and they're like, oh, I probably shouldn't wait, but okay. And you say, yeah, this motivational psychologist really says that, you know, the time to wait is until seventh grade. When seventh grade comes, you say, well, the motivational psychologist says some kids don't really get started in the seventh grade. They wait till the eighth grade. Okay? Oh, yeah, so we're really going to do it differently on the eighth grade because some, you know, he just seems to be, there's some percentage of kids that are slow starters on that issue. So we're going to wait till the eighth grade, then we're going to dig in. And that's what you do. You just keep kicking the can down the road with a story like that, so that you understand the issue, you understand they've got a point, yeah, it makes sense, but you've talked to, you know, Dr. Schmo, the expert about this, and Dr. Schmo tells you, i.e. Big Louie is telling you that this is how you should do it. So that's what we would do. And meanwhile, have the husband listen to this and maybe get a phone consult with me if he's gonna be twisted up into a pretzel. He's actually missing an important component of this child's life, which is that the whole idea here is for the kid to have fun. This is the point of childhood. It's the point of life, is to have fun. Point of life is not to get caught climbing some dominance hierarchy and start when you're four so that somehow you can be one inch ahead of the genetic competition, you know, when you're 19. It's a total fiasco. All right.
Fantastic. And
move
do you
on.
Know of any parenting books from a
no?
Psychologist?
I don't know one. I will be writing a section on this in my book.
Okay.
About,
all right.
Yeah, so we'll get to it. Somebody's finally going to get to it.
All right. The next question. Okay. So this has to do with a little bit of our future episode, a couple of episodes back. So dear Dr.
Okay.
Lyle, I've been paying a lot of attention to the racial polarization that's been occurring in the U.S., and to me it would seem entirely due to our hunter-gatherer tendencies to favor those who look like us, since they would theoretically be carrying similar copies of our genes. Black identity groups proliferate African genes, whilst the alt-right wants to proliferate European genes. But due to historical reasons such as Nazi Germany and slavery, the alt-right is widely condemned and black identity politics is encouraged as a sort of balancing mechanism. What do you think will happen to human population groups over the next, say, 100 years? Will we reach an equilibrium where certain groups dominate their ancestral homelands, like Japanese people dominating Japan, Russians in Russia, or will humans amalgamate into one global race?
Really interesting, really thoughtful and interesting thinking here. And much legitimacy to what this person's thinking through as far as I could see. I would say that what's inevitably going to happen is you're going to get one race. And that's simply – I'm not looking at this as – I'm just looking at this as essentially – this is what almost what you'd look at as fluid dynamics. So this is inevitable that this is headed towards one race. It's just straight gene trading processes. Now, it may take 1,000 years to get all the way essentially to one race. That would be essentially 50 generations. We're never going to live to see it, so this is all just speculation. You can talk about all kinds of things like how they'll have anti-gravity machines in 2350, and you can say anything you want because nobody's going to be able to verify it. But I think you're already seeing it. In other words, you can look in the current time for the trends that that you would be interested in observing, and you can definitely see that the barriers towards interracial mating and child having are clearly being broken down very, very quickly. So the I can remember as a young kid in the 1960s, the idea of seeing an interracial couple, black and white, was very odd. Okay, it was very disturbing for people, and it is no longer, at least where I live in California, and probably this is true most places, it's just really hardly an issue. Now, maybe an issue in small town America, in some places, but this is fading away very quickly, and you can see that this would be a runaway trend. So you can see that once you start to have an awful lot of people who are hybrids, then pretty soon it all starts being completely a non-issue completely. And so that's where this is headed. So I suspect that we're probably, probably less than 1,000 years from having essentially no longer what we would recognize as races. So human beings will be so mobile here in the next, few hundred years that people will be globetrotting all over the planet. There'll be worldwide mating searches, and there will be you essentially be squeezing out the last nth of sexual attractiveness out of everybody's trading capability. You're already seeing this. So this is, people on Match.com or Tinder, if you're cool and young, you're seeing
we're desperate.
Case people aren't, the point is that what's going to happen is these devices for communication having people hook up are actually all about squeezing out the last percentiles of value out of about what it is that you have to trade. So you can see that you would never have a population base of any kind sequester itself. That would be just completely insane. That would be like, well, I'm only going to sell my plumbing services to people in Elk Grove. I'm not going to go 1 mile outside of Elk Grove into Sacramento. I'm only going to do it here. Well, that's a mistake. In other words, you want to be able to extend your services out as wide as you can, because you want to get as many people as you possibly can bidding for your services, and therefore optimize what people would be willing to pay. It would be better, let's suppose, I'll give you a much better example for people that can't easily grasp the supply and demand dynamics here. Let's suppose that I had a Fabergé egg, okay? Very, very expensive, rare Fabergé egg. Eyeball worth $5 million. And I said, I'm only going to sell it to people that live in Sacramento. Nobody else can buy this. Be like, that's insane. The top bidder in Sacramento might only be willing to pay $350,000 for the Fabergé egg. If I've got a Fabergé egg, I want to sell it on the worldwide market. Somebody in Monaco might give me $5 million. But it's like, no, I want to go beyond Monaco. I want to go all the way over to China, because somebody in China is willing to pay me $5.5 million. The bigger my market is, the more value I'm going to be able to squeeze out of the trade. So this is precisely why it is that you're going to find people are going to be mating cross races. If there was no other reason, which there is, but the point is, if there's no other reason, that would be an enormously important reason to go across. Because somewhere out there, there's people that particularly like skinny, brainy psychologists, with floppy hair. Okay, so this is somewhere out there that there's some island of misfit toys where I could get 3% more on my trade. And, of course, as the world comes to us with more communication capabilities, that's exactly what's going to happen. So behind that dynamic, you are going to see one race, and what we now know as races will be gone from this earth within 1,000 years.
Fantastic. Well, we'll never live to see that, but should be interesting if somehow...
It's going to be actually... Yeah. It will be interesting... for them looking back at us, and they will have all this photography, and they'll be able to show time-lapse photography in history classes and show that what took place over several hundred years, and they'll be able to show the molding of the races and the morphing of races into you'll be able to see evidence of the previous races in different, in different, you know, groups of people still 1,000 years from now. But at some point, we would recognize as races will be gone.
Would you predict that in, say, 1,000 years, those people would appear more attractive to us if we were to somehow meet?
No. No, okay. They would look like just like hybrids look now. So there's nothing about someone who's a little bit Latino and a little bit black and a little bit white and a little bit Asian right now. And you'll look at somebody and you can't quite put your finger on what it is that they are. If they're beautiful, they're beautiful. And if they're not beautiful, they're not beautiful. In other words,
it doesn't require some novelty-seeking chip to be into the mixed-race people.
Not even close. It's going to turn out that human beings have beauty detection mechanisms that are essentially looking for imperfections. So if you paddle up the Amazon basin and you talk to some natives that have lived their whole life there and have never seen anybody else, and you show them pictures of white women in Nebraska, cheerleaders, okay, they are just as good at picking the better-looking ones from the less best-looking ones. They will agree basically perfectly with guys that grew up in that town in Nebraska. Okay, they will also agree completely with guys in the middle of China in some Chinese village. They will have exactly the same. It is perfect. So what we're seeing is that the beauty detection mechanisms are human universals, and it doesn't matter what race you grew up with or what you've been exposed to. You can pick it up, okay? Because what you're looking for are invariances with respect to with what is, quote, good genes, and that is detectable anywhere by anybody.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So cool. as you push and pull the races around and mold them and morphs into one race, you'll still have the same you know, bell curve and the same gradations of attractiveness. It'll all look just like it looks now, only kind of funny different, because it's going to be, they'll all be amalgams.
That should be interesting to see. Okay, next question. We have time one more, Delilah, right?
Sure.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, question is twofold. There's a young lady I've been involved with in the past, but who has come back into my life. She's been going through a divorce for a while and is a family friend. She's smart, gorgeous, who I don't think is physically out of my league, but she's definitely been catching my attention even before she announced her divorce. She recently reached out to me and a couple weeks later had sex and have been seeing each other on the weekends for little quasi dates. We have similar interests and both come from moderately successful families. And we both have been through or are going through a divorce. My question being, why do I let myself fall for my attraction for someone who's still going through a divorce? Should I flee any relations long-term with someone who can bring themselves to have an extramarital affair even under the current circumstances?
Okay. First of all, it's a good question. Good question. This is quite a conscientious individual that would even ask such a question. So let's look at this and get to the root of what's going on. What's happening here is that it's useful to know that highly attractive people are almost never on the market. In fact, highly attractive people are almost always poached into the relationship that they are in. Okay? Now, there's very attractive people out there that are listening like, well, that's not true for me. I've been on the sidelines for 8 years. But if we actually looked at those people, there would be reasons why they've been on the sidelines. They may be particularly picky. They may be particularly difficult in some way. There may be reasons why a highly attractive person spends a lot of time on the sidelines. But we're going to find that most highly attractive people are not on the sidelines. And so, and not only are they not on the sidelines, most highly attractive people, to get to them, they have to be poached. And they are, usually. So this individual, this would be this situation. So this individual is not actually on the open market. So the only way to get to this person is, you know, this is, she's very attractive, without any obvious screwball flaws. You know, this isn't some broken 10. This is a highly functional 10. And so this person is not going to be on the market for very long. And so as a result, this guy is sitting in the sweet spot. So he actually is, as she begins the process of testing her market value, and also, you know, because she's going to be going through a process of recalibration. She's going to, you know, she's got some things that she's going to be going through. But we don't know her psychology. We don't know how pair bond oriented she is, how wild she is. We don't know anything from this description. But it doesn't sound like she's a wild child. It sounds like what he's conscientious enough. He's worried about, gee, what does this mean about some woman who would, you know, have a, quote, extramarital affair? Well, it's not really an extramarital affair. This is a person who is, for whatever reasons, there are financial, familial, social, there's all kinds of reasons why she's having to step through a bunch of hoops on the way to what she believes is divorce. She wants out. In the Stone Age, she'd already be out. So she's not wasting any extra time by, when she sees someone she's interested in, she's willing to pursue it. This is very cool. This is it's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with a female who would do this, or with the guy that would also pursue it. This is you're not going to get the sanctimonious Christian talk out of me. These are real live people that are in relationships that are lasting longer formally than they ever would have in the Stone Age, and they're ready to move on. And so they've now found each other, both in that, essentially in that same state. Good luck to them. You know, most relationships where people are coming out of relationships for a while are probably not going to work, just because people have got a lot of calibrating to do and they've got some growing and experimenting to do. But you never can tell. And you know what? That gorgeous 10 isn't going to be on the market for too long. This guy's got a shot at it. Good luck. And good luck with all, and do the best you can, and just see what happens and enjoy it.
Fantastic. All right.
All right.
Excellent. Okay. Dr. Lau, we powered through these.
We did. All good.
I had one question that came up. It's from the first question about the 10 paid dates.
Yes.
And so the question I have is in this particular question, the guy is 58 and she's 53. So my question is, does the natural drop of testosterone in a male lend itself to where he's more willing to wait when he's older for sex and not push for it and make a tactical mistake than when a kid is younger and he's got so much testosterone that he just kind of, you know, screws it up because he's, you know, trying too hard to get sex?
Yeah, very possibly, very good thinking there, and I have no doubt that if we were to chart that and we had 1,000 data points and we were able to watch, you know, cross sections of behavior at 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, we would find that would be true. So, however, that doesn't excuse your behavior, Nate. Yeah.
How did you know how I acted when I was 19? How did you know? You predict everything.
Yeah, just so you know, I've always been really patient. I had no room for error, so I always had to take it slow. So
I'm going
to
call.
We'll
call you Dr. Doug Vasopressin Lyle. How's that?
Yeah, there you go. Oh my goodness! All right, good enough.
Excellent. Yep, it's good. All right, Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. We'll see you all next week. And have a Merry Christmas for all the people who celebrate Christmas, and for all the people who don't, well, have a Merry Christmas anyway.
There you go.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.